Good morning.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
Certainly.
I'd like to start out by having you talk a little bit about how it is you feel we've gotten to this point. It's my understanding from the book that you don't feel that things have always been this bad, and that somehow the kind of professor you see us having today is a fairly recent development. At least it's a post-World War II phenomenon. If the problem is the professor, how did we get the kind of professor that we have?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly when this the current situation developed. In the book, I trace it back to the 19th century with the use of the German university model. Clearly, the universities have changed radically since after World War II, but I think what's happened is more of a matter of degree, where what you have is once was a model of, there used to be two models, I think, of the successful university professor, the professor as teacher and the professor as researcher. And what we've seen since World War II, particularly at schools like the University of Illinois, is the shift of priorities so radically that now there's only a single model of the successful professor, which is the professor as researcher. And what you have is the acceleration of the process of specialization and hyper-specialization, and the narrowing of the focus of the professor into their own specializations, with the concurrent flight from teaching, the devaluing of teaching. And I have to say, but before we get into it, is that there's probably no, as you are well aware, there's probably no university in the country, I think, with the possible exception of Harvard, that I deal with more frequently in the book than the University of Illinois. In fact, the University of Illinois, in a sense, was one of the key case studies in the book, and I'd be glad to talk about specifically what I found at the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Well, before that, just let me ask one more general question, and that is, you know, if it is true that we have shifted our definition of professor, or at least when we think of what they should be doing, we've shifted them from a teacher to a researcher. People are less generalist than they were before and have narrowed their field of interest into very specific kind of ideas. And also, if I think, as you say in the book, an awful lot of what's done now in higher education is driven by the need for or the desire for grant money.
Sure.
And the kind of money that can come from consulting. All of that, you know, was this change a result of circumstances? You know, was it driven by outside circumstances, or do you think that the faculty chose this path for themselves?
A little bit of both. There's no simple answer. Clearly, what happened after World War II is the flood of grant money. Academia suddenly became a ticket to considerable influence and affluence for those who were successful researchers. Society made certain demands on the university that the university responded to by doing much of this research. But clearly, I think that the kinds of priorities we see today are driven internally by the professoriate as a profession that has a considerable power within the university. And I think that what you see that reflected in the curriculum, which tends to follow the interests of the departments and of the professors themselves, clearly not the interests or needs of the students. And so, in a sense, I think that the professoriate has to bear a disproportionate share of the blame for the kinds of things that, for example, I found at the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we get specific? And since you feel that the University of Illinois serves as a good example for the kind of things that you see happening all over in higher education, tell us what you found at the University of Illinois that concerns you.
Well, let me, first of all, talk about why I picked the University of Illinois. One of the interesting things about the University of Illinois is that over the last few years it's gone through what I think is a remarkable exercise in introspection. And almost all the things that I'm going to be talking about the University of Illinois were included in reports published by the administration or from faculty members. So a lot of this is, and that's very unusual, by the way, that a university would go through a process that would highlight its failings, I suppose, so dramatically. So much of what I have is actually from the university. I think, by the way, I just want to say before we get into it is that I'm sorry that the administrators are not in a position to actually have a dialogue with them. They're going to be coming on after me, and I won't have a chance to respond to them. I've never been triple teamed before. That's a first. But specifically, and by the way, before we're done, I would like to be able to give you some questions that had I been had a chance to go on with them, I would have asked them.
Okay.
To discuss.
Sure.
At the University of Illinois, like a lot of the large state universities around the country, and it's not unusual in that, what you have is, and I think that the so-called Mann Report, which I cite heavily in the book, found that because of Dr. Mann said was a institutional inferiority complex on the part of the university, research had been emphasized so heavily that the faculty felt very strongly that the reward system now really devalued teaching quite a bit. As a result, student writing was poor and often neglected by the faculty. The advising program was extremely spotty, and in fact, it's quoted as one dean is quoted in the book as saying, "Faculty advising should be seen as a serious business, but I talk to my faculty until I'm blue in the face, and most still don't take it seriously." Because of the emphasis on research, there's a very heavy reliance on teaching assistants rather than professors at the University of Illinois, and many of those teaching assistants cannot speak understandable English. The curriculum's badly fragmented, and that there's no consensus any longer at the university of what a well-rounded liberal arts education ought to be, and that the faculty is convinced virtually across the board that despite the rhetoric, and your listeners are going to hear quite a lot of that from the administrators in the next hour, saying how they're going to emphasize teaching and how important it is. The fact is the faculty doesn't believe that, and I quote one professor as saying, "Chancellors always talk about how important teaching is at the school, but no one believes them, and in fact, when it comes to decisions on tenure and promotion and hiring, despite that rhetoric, it doesn't count for much of anything." So you have the phenomenon of large classes, large lecture halls, heavy use of teaching assistants. One of the things that was striking about the University of Illinois, and again this comes from the Mann Report, which is an official university publication, one department chairman said that he had a class with many juniors and seniors in it, and found that for 80% of the students, 80% of these juniors and seniors, this was the first class that actually asked them to write a term paper in the first course with essay exams, which is a rather startling finding. And another senior told Dr. Mann that he had been at the University of Illinois for 4 years, but in that 4 years had only had a single professor in his major. So what I found at the University of Illinois was that despite the fact over the years there had been numerous attempts at reform, numerous analyses of what the problem was, that little had been done, and that in fact the situation had gotten rather badly out of whack, and that even administrators at the school, in their moments of candor, will admit that.
So do you think that the reason that the university has been so resistant to change, or at least it has failed to address some of these problems adequately, again, does that go back to the faculty? Do you seem to say in the book that,
sure,
you know, when professors are challenged, they tend to draw their wagons in a circle and have been very resistant to any attempts to change their way of doing things. Is that, again, the root of the problem, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is, and I think that the University of Illinois is a very good example of that. One of the lines in the book, I said, by the mid-1980s, the University of Illinois was like a drunk who had taken a vow of abstinence 40 or 50 times. The record is littered with reports and analyses saying, boy, you know, our writing program's terrible, let's do something about it. And then 5 years later, there's another one saying, let's do something about it. And 5 years later, there's another one saying, boy, we really ought to do something about this. Same thing with the question of advising and the use of teaching assistants and the curriculum. I think in one period, I said between 1935 and 1958 alone, the University of Illinois had addressed itself to developing a coherent core curriculum at least 10 times. This is before even the big movement. And I think that the question is, why is it that periodically somebody rises up and says, boy, you know, we really need to address ourselves to the problems of undergraduate education. This has really gotten out of hand. And they do a study and issue a report, and then nothing happens. And part of that is, I think, goes back to the is where power is in the university. And unlike most organizations, which are like a pyramid with the power on top, the university is like an inverted pyramid, where a lot of the power is focused right at the bottom with the tenured professoriate. And in the book, I quote Vice Chancellor Berdahl, who's going to be on in the next hour, as talking about power at the university, and I quote him as saying, referring to the faculty, they are the university. There is nothing that can be accomplished without them, and there is nothing that can be accomplished against them. And I think that really, in a sense, sums up the history of the frustrated reform at the University of Illinois.
We're talking this morning with Charles Sykes. He's the author of the recently published book, Prof Scam, Professors and the Demise of Higher Education. Mr. Sykes is himself a son of a college professor. He also has been a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal and editor of Milwaukee Magazine. The book is very critical of higher education. We're talking with him this morning, and we welcome your questions and comments, if you have them, as you're listening to Mr. Sykes. Either if you agree or disagree, you'd like to talk with him, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. I have to say that, you know, on this program I've interviewed quite a few authors, and in most cases they're people who are critical of the thing that they are writing about. They're not praising it. But I have seen, or I have read few books that are as unrelievedly negative as yours is, and I wonder, I suppose I just have to keep asking myself what your motivation is, what exactly drives your criticism of higher education? Where does it come from?
I think that part of it has to do with my experience as an adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where a lot of the phenomenon that you see around the universities was there. And frankly, where I'm coming from is that I think that America's, many of the students that I dealt with there and the students at schools like the University of Illinois are being ripped off. I think that the gap between what the university says and what it actually delivers is appalling. And I think it is a very serious problem. And I think that in the book I talk about the fact that the University of Illinois, like other great universities, holds out a certain image of itself to the public, brags about its faculty, brags about its programs. But then when students come there, they find that they often don't see these faculty members. If they do, they're blurs in the parking lot. And the contempt on the part of some of the professors for students, many of whom are making significant sacrifices, or their families making significant sacrifices, is, I think, shocking and appalling. Now, although you said that the book is unrelievedly negative, the fact is that one of the heroes, there are heroes in the book, and some of those heroes are professors who devote themselves to teaching and who really care about teaching. And in fact, a chapter of the book is devoted to a professor at the University of Illinois, Professor Fred Gottheil, in the economics department, who was one of the outstanding teachers that I encountered in my travels around the country. He is unfortunately in a chapter called An Endangered Species. And what we talk about there is what happens to is the view of an outstanding professor. Now, a lot of the criticisms, and I really want to stress this, of the University of Illinois do not come from me. They come from the mouths of professors and deans and official reports of the University of Illinois itself. And the chapter on the Professor Gottheil is entirely in his words, where he talks about the indifference of his colleagues, the fact that he teaches a 1,000-person classroom, and that he does this because doesn't want his colleagues to teach them because he says they are indifferent to the quality of education there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where he talks about, he says, I have 13 teaching assistants, all but one of them is a non-American, some of them don't speak English. The whole structure of this department is not to put a qualified person in front of a class. Now, some people may regard that as negative, but I regard that as a cry from someone who cares deeply about higher education, who cares deeply about the quality of education the students are getting, and is outraged about it. And in that sense, I think the university has to deal not with my book, but with the perception of its own faculty.
I have some callers here. I'd like to involve them in the program. We'll go right to the phones and take someone here. Line number one, our first person. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I call mainly, David, because I knew you'd be disappointed if I didn't. My theory, I haven't got to read your book yet, and I sure will, and I'm going to buy a copy of this tape. But my theory is that in any tax-funded or large insurance-funded institution, why, it becomes so solidified that innovation takes two or three generations. And my other point is that if you sit back and look at it, you can see that the education, public education, has formed itself into a church where only the duly consecrated know what education is and when it's taken place and when it should be done and what it should cost. And I think that this is it's totally teacher-centered, and this is exactly the opposite of what we need in these days of rapidly expanding or turning over knowledge, because the kids come out of the school with virtually no independent learning capabilities, nor the ability to produce materials, teaching materials, that will permit them, or that other people can use, the people who are going to take the information directly from the publishing and apply it to the task. So being typical union behavior, and I am not union bashing, being typical union behavior, why the teachers are more and more making themselves indispensable. And I have great fear for the future based on only this. Can you show me where I'm wrong, please?
Well, I certainly agree with almost everything that the caller has to say, and I am also very concerned about the future. I'm concerned because, in a sense, what you have at a school like University of Illinois is some of the best and the brightest young people in the country, and they are coming, and these are the people who are our hope for the future. And what they're getting is, I'm afraid, is an overdose of the disdain and the indifference of much of the faculty. And what you have is you have a system that seems to be set up for the benefit of the faculty and is really quite rigid and resistant to change. And unfortunately, I think that society is going to pay a tremendous price for this.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Sykes. I think some people might make the argument that by the time a person gets to college, they should be in large part teaching themselves, that going to college is not like being in elementary school, and we expect something very different from the people who are teaching in those two contexts. What do you think about that?
Well, at the University of Illinois, students who arrive ought to be prepared to teach themselves, at least in the first 2 years, because they're not going to get much help from the faculty. Now, that may be very different from the expectation of their parents, who are paying out a good deal of money, or for the taxpayers. But again, I think that that's a rationalization for the priorities of the university. And clearly, a highly motivated student is going to do quite well at a large school like the University of Illinois or the University of Wisconsin. But too many people fall between the cracks. And the problem is that at large universities like Berkeley was another school that I've spent a good deal of time at, what people who've looked at those, and not just myself, have concluded is that not only do students fall between the crack, but that their chance of getting anything like a coherent education is extremely difficult because of the way the curriculum is structured and the way the system is structured. The fact that advising is something that, one of the key things is these students ought to at least have good advisors who tell them something. And one of the department advisors quoted in the book at the University of Illinois is saying that advising is done badly by a lot of people as a reflection of the research emphasis. He said, advising is a part and parcel of teaching, and even though it's required of faculty in this college, many faculty do a terrible job because it doesn't count in the reward structure. The problem is that the reward structure at a school like the University of Illinois is so skewed that it is constantly driving professors away from their students. And to me, that you can rationalize that or try to justify that because students ought to teach themselves. But I think that what that does is to surrender the tradition of higher education.
Okay, let's go back to the phones and talk with someone else here. Line number 3 next. Hello. Hello, is there a caller there?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
I have two questions. One, do you know anything about what surfaces occasionally as a complaint that there are too many graduate students teaching who do not have an adequate command of the English language. And the other is, I think you mentioned that you mentioned Harvard a great deal in your book. Would you make some comparisons between Harvard and the University of Illinois, a la all these things that you've been commenting on? And I'll hang up and listen then.
Okay, two interesting questions. The first question is about the foreign-speaking graduate students. And the interesting thing is, as I have talked about around the country about this book, there is no subject that has received more attention than the foreign-speaking the foreign graduate students. This is a very significant problem throughout the country. In some departments, especially in the sciences, as many as, and this is not, I'm not referring to the University of Illinois necessarily, two-thirds to three-quarters of the graduate students who are teaching classes are foreign graduate students, and many of them do not speak understandable English. And this is a complaint that I have gotten just about everywhere. I don't mean to pick on the foreign graduate students because they have every right to be here, but to me, this is the most dramatic piece of evidence that I can imagine for the contempt that undergraduate teaching is held in this country. The fact is that not only have the professors abandoned the undergraduate classroom, but that they care so little what happens in those classes that they put in their place people who lack minimal communication skills. And this is something that the professor of economics from the University of Illinois talks about in my book very eloquently and dramatically. And frankly, if I were on in your second hour, or the administrators had agreed to come on with me, I would ask them to directly answer this question. I hope one of your callers will ask them, which is, how can you justify, at a school like the University of Illinois, putting teaching assistants in front of undergraduates who may not be able to speak understandable English? Now, they may say that doesn't happen. Some administrators say that doesn't happen, but the fact is that the students and the faculty members say it does happen. And to me, that is appalling.
And
now,
what,
the second part was about Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why I focused on Harvard was that Harvard, in a sense, is a model for universities around the country, and it sets the tone. And many of the same things that you find at the University of Illinois, you find at Harvard. At Harvard has the big classes. Harvard has professors who don't teach. Harvard has is not a particularly warm, cuddly institution for underclassmen. And you do find heavy use of teaching assistants, and in fact, heavy use of teaching assistants who don't speak English. So, in a sense, Harvard has set the tone for universities, and I think that what you have around the country is schools who emulate that particular model. And in the rise to increase their prestige, they tend to imitate it. So, quality of undergraduate education at Harvard is frankly not outstanding. A lot of the great schools in the country have their reputation based on their research and on their graduate schools, and this often does not reflect on the quality of their undergraduate education.
Okay, let's go to another caller on our toll-free line here, number 4. Hello.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a professor at another Illinois university, not Champaign-Urbana, and I can give part of an answer as to why we have graduate students with bad English skills out teaching classes. A large part of it happens because we have small numbers of students of any sort who want to pursue careers in math, as one example. Two-thirds of our students come in thinking that they're going to major in either business or in computer science, in both cases something that requires math. We have so darn many students that we have to turn them away in droves, and the only way we can get any offering of classroom work for them at all is to take anybody who looks like a qualified graduate student and say, please help us out, take another section. That's a very difficult problem. But I think part of it is that consists of whether we have the money to hire additional mathematicians, as one example. I also have another problem with what you're saying. Not a problem for me. I understand the system. I don't like it. But a problem in explaining to the rest of the world how perfectly good intentions have ended up with a system which punishes teaching and punishes other things which we're supposed to do in addition to research. What happens is that we've tried to arrive at a system in which a professor is judged by peers. But we have to worry, well, we can't have people judged by the members of their own department. Sometimes there's stress and other kinds of things, interpersonal stuff, that we want to avoid. So we ask other parts of the university to Well, review the qualifications of our professors. Now, when I'm on such a review committee, I am forced to try to judge mathematicians when my math is pretty bad. Well, how do I judge? Well, the only way I can judge is to look at, gosh, does this guy publish a lot? Does he publish in the right places? Is he doing research that mathematicians think is right? And that's a rotten standard. As a matter of fact, I would be much happier if I could read the man's work and say, hey, this is good, that's junk. Let's not force this guy to publish all kinds of stuff. Let's wait until he has something to say. I don't get that chance. I have to judge under circumstances which are supposedly going to lead to neutral judgment. And they're rotten.
Well, the caller raises a very interesting question, which is how a system develops through perfectly good intentions. And in fact, there's no question about that. Is the desire to evaluate people on the basis of research and to emphasize research, if that research was particularly valuable, if it really was expanding the bounds of human knowledge, then it would be a marvelous thing. In fact, what the caller is referring to, I think, is the pressure to publish in volume. And what that's done to the system, and again, Professor Gottheil from the University of Illinois talked about that, and he said, you know, there once was a time when you could spend a few years thinking through an important intellectual problem, but now the pressure is very, very intense to publish as quickly as possible. You have to turn out six articles to get tenure. He says, you can't write books, because if you write books, then it's all in the oven and you don't have anything to show on your vita and you're not going to survive. He said, the people that we're turning out of my department have no particular interest in pursuing intellectual questions. What they want to produce is articles you can publish in the most hyper-specialized journal, you know, filled with all kinds of charts and graphs and everything. And what's done is, obviously, someone who's not a fellow specialist has no way of evaluating that. And the value of the work in itself is becoming highly questionable. But the empire is built on the basis of that. Now, one thing I argue in the book, which I know is quite controversial, is that out of the ocean of academic research produced by academia, the amount that's valuable is only a teaspoonful. And I think that that's sort of academia's dirty little secret.
We're talking this morning with Charles Sykes. He's the author of the book Prof Scam. It's recently been published. It's a book very critical of higher education, professors in particular. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and we're talking this morning with Charles Sykes. Mr. Sykes is the author of the book Prof Scam, Professors and the Demise of Higher Education. He is himself the son of a professor. He was a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal and editor of Milwaukee Magazine. His book has been recently published. It is very critical of higher education and professors in particular. We have several callers here. We'll get right back to the phones, give you the opportunity to react to some of the things that Mr. Sykes has to say. All you need to do is call us, 333-9455. We also have the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. That's good in Illinois only, sorry to say, for those Indiana folks. We'll go here to another caller. Next up on our line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd just like to make a comment to which I would invite him to respond. I had 14 years in higher education, both in the arts and in the sciences, public and private schools. And in my observation, there is a normal curve in terms of professors, just as there is in any other sector of life. In the private sector, in business, there are some really bad people and some really good people. And I'm wondering if he's aware of the fact, one of my degrees was from Harvard. I had one full professor there who was teaching five courses, and he was also on the forefront of research in his field. People all over the world quoted him. He was teaching those five courses because he said, they've got to be taught. I only have to teach one, but I've got to communicate this. And this was one of the professors, one of several professors I had at Harvard, who received standing ovations from the students in their lectures on occasion. And I just want to know if the guest is aware of the fact that there are some very good people out there, and perhaps something could be learned from them rather than just bashing the whole system.
Well, absolutely. I do know that there are people like that, and in fact, that's why I devoted one chapter to the professor from the University of Illinois, who was a gifted and talented teacher. A couple of problems. One is the changing priorities of the university. At every school I went to,
searched out professors like the one the caller is talking about, the really committed teachers. And many of them had received tenure 20, 30 years ago in an era in which the balance of the priorities was a little bit more rational, I think. And I asked them, if you were coming up through the system now, would you get tenure? And almost invariably they told me, I'm afraid not, because now you're evaluated solely on your ability to publish in the itty-bitty little scholarly journals, and I care too much about teaching. If I was teaching three or four, or in the caller's case, five classes, and I was known as a teacher, there would be no way I would get tenure here. And in fact, I have a chapter in the book called The Crucifixion of Teaching, and it starts off with the story of a Harvard professor who had received standing ovations in his lectures. In fact, won Harvard's top award for teaching. His name is Alan Brinkley. The next year, he was denied tenure. And at the time that Alan Brinkley was denied tenure, three of the last four professors who won the teaching award had been denied tenure. And throughout the country, professors told me, from Harvard, Yale, Northwestern University, Illinois on down, said, the situation has gotten so bad that if you are known as a teacher, if you win a teaching award, it's almost the kiss of death. It's a negative. So what's happening is not that there are not outstanding professors within higher education. It's that many of these outstanding people are being driven out of the academy. Those who are in now are going to be replaced. I don't deny that there are wonderful professors now. My question is, 20 years from now, who's going to replace them? Because the people coming up through the system now are being told in no uncertain terms what they, how they're going to be evaluated and how to survive. And the fact is that right now, an outstanding researcher who is a lousy teacher is probably going to get tenure, whereas an outstanding teacher who does not do all that much research, there's just no place for him at a school like Harvard or at the University of Illinois.
Well, and
that really concerns me.
Let me, again, sort of follow up on something that the caller had said, the observation being that in every profession, you're going to find a range of talent.
Sure.
You'll find people that are great and find people that are not so great. Should we really expect university professors to be any different or have a higher percentage of excellence than any other profession?
No, probably not, but that's not my point. My point is that what you have is a system that is fundamentally biased against certain kinds of excellence. And the kind of excellence that the system is biased against is exactly the kind of excellence that is most important to America's undergraduate students, which is teaching. That in the system, those professors who really devote themselves to teaching, who care about their students, who deal with them one-on-one, possibly at the expense of publishing for some obscure journal that has a circulation of 150 people and is never read by anyone, that professor is going to be at a tremendous disadvantage. And increasingly, there is no place for that kind of professor at the big universities. And I think frankly, that's tragic.
Let's take another caller here, line number two next. Hello.
Yes. Yes. I teach at the University of Illinois. I've taught here for over 20 years. And I recognize what Mr. Sykes is talking about when he talks about the imbalance between rewarding teaching and research. And in fact, the Q report, the so-called Q report, which was issued by a committee appointed by the Senate, says virtually the same thing that he does. The interesting question is whether this report will be implemented, that is to say, to give equal recognition for teaching and for research and publication. Now, that question, whether it will be implemented, relates to the point that I want to make now. I agree with Mr. Sykes on this imbalance. Where I see the system very differently from having worked within it is in the power distribution that he describes. That is to say, all the power at the base, an inverse pyramid. And in fact, it seems to me that the University of Illinois perhaps is a bit peculiar in its form of organization, because formally departments have a choice between headships and chair forms of organization. The chair form of organization is a more democratic form. The power relies in an executive committee in the departments. The headship, the head has total power. It's like a Leviathan. And each head looks up at the next level, at the dean or the school director. And the dean and the school director looks up at the vice chancellor, and they look up to the chancellor. And my perception and many other faculty members, and certainly the perception of the union, the UPE here on campus, an affiliate of the AFT, is that one of the major issues here is precisely governance, that the university is governed from above, and that the only way something like the Q report is going to get implemented is if the signals come from above and are sent down. And I might tell you that while there is formally an option in the form of governance here, it is very difficult for a department to switch from a headship to a chair form of organization because the higher administrators do not wish it. It is very difficult for the faculty advisory committee, an elected body, to overturn decisions of decision-making. I'd like him to address that because I think there's a specificity at the University of Illinois which perhaps he is missing and thus blaming those of us on the faculty who really feel quite powerless in many occasions.
I certainly don't dispute what you say. I don't particularly deal with that question in the book, and it's a very interesting point. Let me ask the caller a question. What do you think? Do you think that the recommendations of the Q report will, in fact, be implemented?
I have severe reservations that it will, and I say that not because I don't want to see it. I obviously agree with the recommendations. But I think that there is almost a kind of ideological hold which has taken place, that in fact research is the most important thing, that we have the great research library and that we select out the people who are researchers basically, and we've convinced ourselves of another myth, another ideological myth, that is to say that good teaching and good research go together. So you judge the person on the basis of research and you can assume the good teaching unless there's horrible evidence to the contrary. So I think it's a really uphill battle to get the Q report implemented. I mean, I'd like to hear Vice Chancellor Bergdahl and some of the other people address that question because it would seem to me a rather revolutionary prospect. I hope so.
Yeah, this is what's interesting to me about this is at the University of Illinois, because of the Q report and because of the Mann report, what the problem is no secret. The situation is very well documented. It's very, very forcefully argued. It's there. I mean, you can pick it up and see what the problems are. A lot of the problems I've been talking about undergraduate education. The real question comes now, having identified these very severe problems, what will the university actually do? And when I was there, I found a great deal of skepticism of people who, one person dubbed the Mann Report, and I quote him in the book as saying, called it Operation Wheel Spin. He said this is something we have to go through every few years to show that the more things change, the more they stay the same. But in fact, having identified these severe problems, what will the university do about them? And the track record thus far is very discouraging. I have to say that at the university, Chancellor Bergdahl is well known as someone who has taken a very positive approach to this and seems genuinely committed to improving undergraduate education. But I think that over the next few years, what happens will be almost a case study in the reform of higher education.
We're moving into our last 10 minutes. Charles Sykes is our guest. He's author of the book ProfScam, Professors and the Demise of Higher Education. I have a couple of other people on hold, and I want to make sure that we can get them in before we have to finish. So I want to go on to our next caller. That's on line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I agreed with the last caller. It seems to me that everybody agrees on what the problem is. It's not at all controversial to say that this is the problem, but it's a question of analyzing what the why is. And your guest points out that the structure as such is to tell professors and everybody else that the important thing is research. So it seems to me a bit absurd to then turn around and say, well, okay, we're going to blame the professors for doing, you know, essentially that which they're told, okay, if you don't do this, you get fired. The real question, it seems to me, is how to change the structure of the university so that it will reflect what it's supposed to reflect. I've been here since the fall of 82, and I'm now a graduate student, and it seems to me that the many parts of the university that have sort of been sold off to private corporations, many parts of the engineering school, for example, are in some sense economically autonomous and don't have to answer to anybody. At the same time, when the recommendation is put across that there should be more undergraduate mathematics instruction, the money is not forthcoming to do that. So I get the feeling that problems are being addressed in isolation and that there's lots of hot air because you can go on all day about how you're going to improve undergraduate mathematics instruction, but nobody's going to pay for it. So I think a lot of us get a little skittish because we understand that the structure is such that we don't have any say in it. I'm a graduate student, and I teach, and we understand very well that we don't have any say in what's going on, that every once in a while these criticisms come up, which have a good basis, but what the criticisms are used for is often something insidious. Like, for example, I teach in the math department. There are other there are foreign students that teach in the math department. Quite often it happens that criticism comes against the foreign TAs, which is not at all justified. The students haven't even gone to the class and say, oh, I can't go to that class, the foreign TA, and they don't speak English. People will transfer into my class saying, you know, I can't take this foreign class. They decided not to take it just because they saw the TA had a foreign-sounding name. They never even went to the class. So I think there's a danger once you recognize all these problems, if you have a very kind of simplistic and naive analysis that says there's this vicious conspiracy cabal of these rich liberal professors are, you know, spending all their time in research and not recognizing that it's an institutional problem, that the constraints have been set up by the layer of managers in the university and what is their institutional agenda in terms of selling the university to the corporations and stuff.
Well, you raised some good questions, and I agree with most of what you have to say. I think that the system that you're talking about, unfortunately, yes, the professors and graduate students are often victims of this system. Now, who created the system is another question, and I argue in the book that over the years that the system is essentially created by the professoriate as a whole. That doesn't necessarily mean that all individual professors are responsible for it. But the caller does raise some interesting questions. And as for the complaints about foreign teaching assistants, of course there are some illegitimate complaints. On the other hand, it is a genuine problem. It is a real problem, and I think that it ought not to be dismissed totally out of hand.
Let me just ask you, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to talk about what you think should be done to change things. And you do have one chapter in the book that where you outline specifically some of the things that you think it would be good to do. How would you like to see the system as it is changed?
Well, I think that it's going to have to be done on a school-by-school basis. And I think that the heart of it is to reorient the priorities of the university to say that undergraduate teaching is at least our top priority, that our reward system is balanced, that there is a place in this university for people who are outstanding teachers and who regard that as their primary job. And to do that, you're going to have to change the fundamental reward structure of the university. And you're not going to have to just issue reports and say nice things about undergraduate teaching, but you're going to have to show it to the professors. Because, frankly, at the University of Illinois, the professors have heard this rhetoric again and again and again, and they don't believe it because they know that the rewards are not there, and that's going to be crucial. A school like the University of Illinois is not going to be changed easily, and there are no simple answers for it. What might work at one school might work at another, might not work at another. But I think that alone would be something. I do want to go back to one thing the caller said, which was that everybody recognizes what the problems are, and I'm glad to hear him say that. But in fact, throughout the country, you'd be surprised how many universities simply refuse to acknowledge that these problems of undergraduate education take place, who just simply deny that there's any problem at all and who won't even deal with it. What's different about the University of Illinois, I think, is that you have administrators who are candid and who do say there is a problem. Now, whether they'll do anything about it is something I don't know.
Yeah, let's go. I guess I should go down to some more callers again because we've got about 5-6 minutes left. Let's go on to our toll-free line for another caller.
Hello.
Hello, yes.
I agree. First of all, I teach in higher education, although not at U of I, and I agree with a lot with what Professor Sykes and Mr. Sykes has said. I think, though, I definitely disagree about the power base that he mentions, and what I would suggest in terms of not so much historically how the problem has come about, but in terms of power, it starts with accreditation associations.
Mm-hmm.
They accredit universities and departments and the like, and they set standards of research, and I don't know how long that goes back. And so it starts with accreditation associations, and the universities then accept the standards, and it becomes a full circle with the professor as the victim, who's simply trying to comply with the system.
Absolutely true, yes.
And then there's a second part of it that troubles me as one who was in the system, is that once you get in the circle, you find that a lot of people that are judging your work, like deans and the chairs, don't do any research at all, which just makes it ludicrous.
Well, the caller makes some good points. Obviously, all professors are not in control of their destiny. In the book, it's very difficult to simplify an argument in a full book. I talk about the academic villages, which in a sense are the various disciplines run by the professors, which establish the prestige mechanisms, which control the journals, which determine what the priorities are. And these are also reflected through the accrediting things. And yes, this is where these standards come from. Now, I trace that back to the professoriate as a whole, but clearly in individual cases it can be very, very oppressive.
Let's go on to another caller here, line number one, our next person.
Yes, I teach at the University of Illinois, and I'm calling partly to say that I do sympathize with some of what this speaker is saying, but I also think there's an important dimension left out. I guess I agree with some of the points concerning the reward system, but I think that there is a tendency insofar as U of I is trying to set up a reward system only to look at numerical statistics, and I find that more than the pressure to do research is getting in the way of quality teaching. Let me just illustrate a bit more. Most of my colleagues and people I know in other departments, and I certainly am this way, really enjoy certain aspects of teaching and are quite committed to doing what we consider to be a good job. That is, we enjoy thinking about the course design, thinking about ways to improve pedagogy, and meeting with students individually has been very important to me. There are things I don't like, however. I don't like trying to be a crowd pleaser, and I find that the pressure is in that direction because the measurement will come out in what are here called ICs, the evaluations by students. Another measure is number of students we get in our classes. And I find that now with a new talk about how we have to look more towards quality teaching, there's an awful lot of emphasis on numbers that seems to be emerging. Whereas if in the past, and this has definitely happened to me, if I were to say to a chair or to perhaps to some members of the department other than the chair or some administrators, well, I've turned out an invitation to give a paper at a conference because I'm teaching a new course, and I really want to put a lot of time into that, and I just don't think I should take time away from that to give this paper or write this paper for a book. They would be really disturbed. You know, they would let me know that my priorities were wrong, and they'd be surprised. So I think that we are very much discouraged from putting a great deal of time into the preparation, into meeting with students, at the same time that we may well be punished if we get low teaching evaluations. So I think that the reward system is skewed in a slightly different way from the way you've been talking.
No, I think that's very interesting. In fact, the numbers game played by campuses is a very important phenomenon to understanding what's going on with the curriculum, and I do talk about that in the book. So I am familiar with it, and you raise a very valid point.
I want to try and squeeze one more person
well,
in
let me
here.
Just, let me,
oh,
let me,
yeah, go ahead.
Let
you
me
want...
just say that...
Yeah.
As I said earlier in the show, and I'm sorry that I don't have a chance to engage in a dialogue with the three high-powered administrators who are going to be on the next hour, I can understand why they would want to be on to be able to answer. As I said, I've never been triple-teamed before. I won't have a chance, of course, to respond to anything that they say about the book. And I know this may sound a little bit crass, but... I do feel it's something of a disadvantage there. The book is available at the Book Center in the Illini Union, and for people who have any questions about it or points that I may not have made clear, I would certainly refer them to that. And if there are any points raised by the administrators that I don't have an opportunity to respond to, I hope that they can get a copy of the book to deal with and certainly contact me in Milwaukee if they have any questions.
Okay, good enough. Another caller here on our toll-free line. Hello. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I recently retired from 30 years of teaching and research at a state university in Illinois, in the northern part of Illinois. From all this experience, I must say that Mr. Sykes is accurate in his description of the situation as it is in higher education. I once taught a course on research literature. It might have been 15 years ago that Hans Bethe, the Nobel Prize physicist at Cornell, calculated that if the Physical Review grows over the next 10 years at the same rate it grew over the last 10 years, it will be larger than the Earth. The volume, the sheer volume of literature that is being published denies its availability to people even in the field. I couldn't keep up with the literature in my own specialty. Furthermore, the cost of this literature to the libraries is overwhelming the libraries. We simply can't keep up paying for the enormity of the cost of the scientific, I happen to be in science, of the literature that's being published by researchers. And in my own field, the least, that is in the sciences, the least qualified persons taught the freshman and sophomore classes. No professor that was of the professor rank would teach these courses. Those who did not have a PhD or had less experience than others were the persons that taught the 300, 400, 500 student introductory courses, the general education courses. So I have no question. I just want to confirm from my own 30 years of experience that this there's one other thing. Years ago, the medical schools of this country were in rather disarray. There was no qualified uniform education of doctors. I don't remember the name of the report, but a report was done which revolutionized medical education in this country. And after all, that is graduate education. And now today, there are no C medical schools or B. They're all Class A, as I understand it. They're all qualified, and it came about through the need, the disarray in the teaching of medical education.
I thank the caller. I'm going to have to jump in because we're at the end of our time. I just wanted to give you, Mr. Sykes, a chance if you want to make a final comment to go ahead and do that.
No, I really appreciate the caller's comments, and I think that people who have been in academia for a long time will recognize many of the things that I talk about in ProfScam, that it, in a sense, a lot of what I'm talking about is not particularly new. It's been happening for quite a long time. My argument is that it's that the trends are increasingly troublesome. And while I'm certainly hopeful that a school like the University of Illinois, because I have to compliment the administrators who are about to come on, have at least had the candor and the honesty to acknowledge the existence of many of these problems. My home state, University of Wisconsin, the administrators simply will not acknowledge there's anything wrong with undergraduate education. So in that sense, Chancellor Berdahl and his colleagues are way ahead. Whether, in fact, they'll be successful, I'm not sure.
Okay, we'll have to leave it at that. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And for people who are interested in reading more on the topic, you might take a look at our guest's book. His name is Charles Sykes, and the book is Prof Scam, Professors and the Demise of Higher Education. Thanks very much for spending the time with us.
Well, thank you.